me. And one of the nurses came over and said to me, said, in the morning, would you go over and talk to that fellow in the bed across from you? Because his wounds are very similar to yours, and he's not doing very well. He's really struggling to hold on to life. And maybe if you kind of went over and just sat by him and, you know, write him a few notes, tell him what happened and, you know, what you're doing to heal and things that, you know, maybe you can help him to get over this. So I said, yeah, I'd do that. So I'm laying in bed and I go to sleep and I wake up the next morning and I look over and his bed is empty. So when the nurse came over, I said, what happened to the guy across the way? And he says, he died in the night. He didn't survive. And I thought, this was the first time I thought that this was serious. This, what happened to me was a serious thing. It was a life-threatening thing that had happened, and it began to take on some new meaning. But the Spirit was still with me, and the Spirit was telling me that I could survive and that I would eventually learn to talk and to use my left arm and to be a functional person again. Well, to speed up this process, so, you know, you have to listen to my whole life story. Eventually, they sent me to a hospital, an army hospital in the States, and they processed me through, and I was there for several months, and they treated me very nice. I was treated with a great deal of dignity while I was there, which is not necessarily the treatment that most Vietnam vets got when they returned home, but I was very fortunate that I was around some very good people there, and they gave me a full retirement at the ripe old age of 19. The Army gave me a full retirement and sent me to a VA hospital. Well, I stayed in that VA hospital almost a year, and they told me that, you know, they're going to cut off my left arm. I had had this trach tube in my throat for the whole time, ever since I was injured, and they told me that was permanent. I kept asking, you know, when am I going to get this thing out? They said, well, it's, you know, that's permanent. In fact, we're going to put in a different one that's even more permanent. And they told me that, you know, eventually I could get some plastic surgery on my face to fix it up and an artificial eye, and you know, they'd make me look a little better, but I'd probably end up being in the hospital for a very long time, if not for the rest of my life, and that my life would probably be a short one. Well, I didn't really buy that, so I went into my doctor one day after I was really fed up with being in the hospital for so long, and I wrote him a little note, and I put it on his desk, and I said, what happens if I take this tube out of my neck? And he just looks at me and he says, you die. So I took it out and laid it on his desk, and I wrote him a little note that said, goodbye, I'm going home to die. And I left. Well, I'm not totally stupid. What I had done was I went down to the library in the hospital, and I went down to the medical library, and I learned about this tissue that we have in our neck, in our throat, and what happens when you take that trach tube out. I learned that they don't stitch up the hole or anything. Usually it just closes up on its own, and it heals by itself. And you don't really have to do much but keep it clean and keep something over it, and it'll do just fine. So that's what I did. I just took care of myself. I did go back and get all the plastic surgery, and the plastic surgeons were great. They did a good job. They rebuilt my face with cartilage from the UCLA cartilage bank and rebuilt the right side of my face, and I looked pretty much like I did before the incident, but I was very fortunate that I didn't cave in to all the negativism. And it was that spirit from that light, from that near-death experience, that gave me the faith to keep going. And it has given me the faith through all these years to keep going. For about 3 years after my near-death experience, that light was with me and that spirit was with me at all times. And I had this great drive to go to college and to do things that I never thought I would do, especially go to college, because when I left high school, I walked out and said, I never want to step into another classroom again. And for the last 35 years, I've pretty much been in a classroom the whole time. I've been going to school and lecturing at colleges and universities and high schools and junior highs and grade schools all over the area. And so it's just been one classroom after another. But I went through some bad times, too. I mean, it wasn't all good. After about 3 years, and I had tried to talk about this near-death experience with people, and it was hard because I couldn't speak. It took me a long time to learn to speak, by the way. But I couldn't speak, so it was hard to communicate. And as those of you that have had a near-death experience know, there aren't many words in the English language that can describe that out-of-body experience and being in that white light and the feeling that you have and the reality that exists within that white light and that other dimension out there. So I tried talking to people, and most of the people I tried to talk to didn't really want to hear it. They kind of looked at me like I was crazy. So eventually I just stopped talking about it. I didn't bring it up, and I just kind of forgot it myself. I let it go. But when I let go of that spirit, it faded away, and my life just kind of went right down in the toilet. I'd been married for about 10 years. I got divorced. I got a good job, and then I got laid off and couldn't find work again. My life was really in the toilet. I used up all my savings, and I couldn't get a job, and I couldn't seem to find a way out of this mess. And through a series of interesting incidents, I was sitting in my living room with what there was of it. I had a little plastic couch and a file cabinet with a lamp on it and a TV that was kind of sitting on the floor and some shelves that were made out of bricks and boards and a card table and in my dining room with a couple of folding chairs. And I pretty much lost everything at this point. And I was thinking about going back to the light, seriously. And I had a rifle in my bedroom. I was ready to go stick it in my mouth and blow my head off and go back there. I thought maybe whatever I was supposed to do, maybe I'd done it and it was time to leave. So I'm sitting there thinking about it, and there's a knock at the door. I think, oh, I don't want to talk to anybody. I really don't. Well, the knock persisted. So I thought, all right, I get up and see who it is. And I open the door, and there's the Avon lady. And I thought, what the heck's going on here, you know? And so she just kind of pushes her way in and starts telling me about Avon products. And it didn't take her long to figure out that I wasn't really interested. I was sitting there, and she started telling me about her church. And I thought, oh, you know, I really don't want to hear this crapola about church and all that stuff. You know, I've been to church. I didn't want to go back to church. My church experiences weren't pleasant ones. And, you know, they didn't understand my near-death experience. So I really didn't want to hear it. But I listened, she was telling me about this singles group, and they were going on a retreat the next weekend, and you know, it'd be wonderful if I could go with them and maybe, you know, they'd listen to some of the Bible studies and, you know, get a little of that spirituality going. And I thought, well, I don't know. I don't really want to go. And then she mentioned that it cost $60. And I thought, aha, I don't have $60. Here's my way out. So I said, well, and I'd really love to go. It sounds wonderful, but I don't have $60. So sorry, and, you know, I'm heading for the door to open it up. And she says, well, my husband and I offer scholarships to people that can't afford to pay the $60. And I said, well, gosh, there are now. What the heck am I going to do, you know? So I let her pay the tuition, and I went to the retreat. And actually turned out to be a very wonderful experience. And I kind of reconnected with that white light and my spirit. And I came home very renewed, very full of the light again. And I didn't go back to her church, but I was full of the spirit again. And I began to think about that white light, and I began to think about that spirit that had carried me through all the difficult times, that had helped me to heal and helped me to learn to talk when the doctor said that I would never be able to talk. By the way, I still don't have any vocal cords. I went to this doctor, and he says, I was talking to him, and I said, you know, I'm having some trouble breathing, and I, you know, maybe you could help me, I said, he said something about the quality of my voice, and said, well, I don't have any vocal cords. And this was about, I don't know, this was quite some time ago, 1987, I think, I was still struggling a little bit with my speech, and he said, well, you speak pretty well, you must have some vocal cords in there. So he got all his little fiber optic cameras and stuff and went down and looked in my throat, and he's looking at it, and we're looking at the little TV screen. I didn't really know what I was looking at, but after he finished looking down there, he turned to me, and he reaches his hand out, and he says, Bill, my name's Al, and he shook my hand, and he said, you're right, you don't have any vocal cords. See, he says, but I think what happens is you rattle some scar tissue in your throat, and that's how you make noise and talk, so that's how I talk. But I went through this kind of renewal, this sense of finding my spirit again. And the spirit told me that I needed to talk to people. And I thought, what does that mean? You know, what am I going to do? How am I going to talk to people? By the way, I'd been working in the automotive industry through this time. I actually owned my own auto shop for a period of time, and then I worked for an automotive research company for a while, and they were the ones that laid me off. And I'd been looking for work in the automotive industry because that's where all my experience was. But the spirit said, you know, you have to go talk. And I thought, I don't know how I'm supposed to do that. How am I supposed to fulfill this thing about talking to people? And so I went out, and I went to a vocational counselor, a headhunter looking for a job, and as he was talking to me about the job market and what I needed to do and all this, I thought, I want your job. So I told him, I said, I want your job. I want to do what you do. And he says, oh, but, you know, it takes years of college and all the experience, and you don't speak well, and you could never do that. And so he just kind of blew me off, and so I just kind of blew him off and left. And I went looking for work, talking to people. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I went to this job that was in the automotive industry, but it had to do with selling, and I thought, well, that's talking to people. So I could kind of be selling automotive parts and talking to people, and maybe that's what I'm supposed to do. So I went to this company. I went for my job interview. And the guy took me in, we sat down, he was really nice, very personable, we had a wonderful chat for about 45 minutes or so, and he looked at me and says, Bill, you're the most qualified guy that has applied for this job. And he says, I would really love to hire you, but you know what? I think you're more suited for the social services. And I thought, well, where the heck did that come from? You know, the social service, I never even imagined that. I never thought about it. It never crossed my mind. So I left. I was really upset because I wanted that job, and I left, and I started thinking about social services. Well, Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm supposed to talk to people in the social services. But I have a degree in auto mechanics. How am I supposed to get a job in the social services? So I thought, well, what I have to do is go back to college. So I applied to the VA for vocational rehabilitation, figuring they'd send me to college again. Since they paid for my GI Bill once, I thought maybe they'd, you know, give me some more money to go to college. They turned me down, and I was very upset. So I went in, and I wanted to talk to the head honcho at the vocational rehabilitation department. And I went in, and I told the guy at the desk, I want to see the head man and find out why I can't get vocational rehabilitation. And he goes, yeah, okay, I'll let you see somebody. He leads me back to this little office that's no bigger than a closet. And there's a guy sitting in there behind the desk, and he says, you know, how can I help you? And I just read him the riot act. I call him bad names and cuss him out up one side and down the other. And he just kind of sits there and takes it all. And, you know, I just vented all my anger on him. I don't know if you've been around a Vietnam vet that's angry, but, boy, they can vent. And I did. I mean, I went on for quite a while. And as soon as I finished, he looked right at me and says, you ever thought about being a counselor? What are you talking about, mister? You know, I just read you the riot act, and you asked me if I want to be a counselor. So I said, yeah, that's what I'm looking for. I want to be a counselor. So he sends me out on a job interview, and sure enough, I get the job. I wasn't the best qualified for the job, but for some reason, I got the job. And that job, through some odd twists and turns, led to another job in the mental health field. And I ended up spending almost 20 years working in the mental health field and talking to people every day. I went back to school and I got a degree in psychology and a master's degree in social work and things that I thought I could never do, I did. And I became a veterans counselor. I worked for the VA. And at first I started working with Vietnam vets. And I'd worked in the vet center system prior to that for a little bit. And then when they started an inpatient treatment for post-traumatic stress, I joined that program. And after about 5 years, I realized that I was kind of burning out on my own issues, my own post-traumatic stress. And even though I'd gotten some help for that earlier, I realized that I needed to do something else. So I volunteered to go over to the acute psych ward and work with psychiatric patients. Well, what I found out was that was one of the reasons that I was sent back here. That was one of my higher purposes to fulfill. And I developed a treatment for schizophrenic patients that also had substance abuse that got them out of the hospital, living independently. We were able to cut the psych beds from 160 down to 80 and later down to 30 because of this program. That was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. And I did that for many years, and suddenly the spirit started talking to me again, saying, it's time to quit, it's time to leave. And I thought, you know, I kind of like what I'm doing, and I really don't want to leave, but, you know, the spirit calls, and I've learned over the years that when the spirit calls, you go. Even if you don't like where you're going, you go, because that's what you're supposed to do. By this time I had been speaking at IONS meetings for 10 years, and everybody there was urging me, write a book, write a book, write a book. So I sat down and I wrote this whole story out in detail. I wrote the book, and that's what brings me here tonight. And the Spirit has told me over and over again over the last several years, talk to people, but this time more people. bigger groups, not so much one-on-one, and not so much people that need a lot of attention, but go talk to bigger groups. So I'm here talking to you tonight. And I'm going to be traveling all over the country talking to people. If they pay me to come talk to them, great. If they don't, that's fine too. I'm going to talk to them. So that's what I do. And over the years, I've learned to speak. I've learned to rattle that scar tissue in my throat. I've learned to communicate with people. And ever since that reawakening, that spirit has been with me. And it's guided me. And it's talked to me. And it's told me where to go and what to do. And even though sometimes I don't see the, you know, the light, I follow the spirit. If the spirit says get in your car and drive to Salt Lake City and talk to a group of people, that's what I do. You know, if it says get in your car and drive all over the country and talk to people, that's what I do. I go talk to them. And somehow, everything I need, the spirit provides. It gives me everything I need. Not everything I want, just everything I need. Unfortunately, I want a lot more, but you know, you, after a while you learn that you just kind of go with the flow and you have faith. And I've learned to have faith in this spirit. I've learned to have faith that this spirit will provide me with everything I need. This spirit will take me where I need to go. It will help me to fulfill my higher purpose. It will help me to do all the things that I need to do, and eventually it will take me back to that white light. And I'll go back to that white light at exactly the moment I left. And I will begin a new life in that dimension. But before I do that, I have to live this life to its natural conclusion, whatever that may be. And I have to live this life in a human body, one that's certainly not perfect by any means. And as I age, it gets less perfect. So we struggle, I think, sometimes with this humanness, and we struggle with the conflict between the beauty and the peace and the drive of our spirit and the struggle that we have as human beings on this earth. And I think that we oftentimes struggle with the conflict of trying to be a very spiritual person and at the same time trying to deal with our human side, our human being. And I think that it's really it's important to know that you can have both. That by having faith in the spirit, you also have faith in the human being. And they go hand in hand. And that faith will carry you wherever you need to go. It'll take you on your journey. And you can start that journey anytime. It's never too late and it's never too early. And many of you have already started your journey, and many are still looking to start. And you will. Everyone here has a purpose. And you will fulfill that purpose. And your spirit will guide you if you give it the chance to. And you will fulfill your life. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Any of those who would like to ask questions, I think they'll be willing to take. We'll let them get a shot of water here and moisten up those scar tissues. It's pretty remarkable, really, to think.
It hurts. You have to do it.
This is a nice guy. We've had him stay in our home. And got a sweet, gentle spirit, and for that, you know, coming from someone who had to be, you know, combat hardened, I mean, this is transitions that, I don't know, most of us, I've never been in war. My father was a veteran too, but, you know, that was another generation. It's a kind of trauma that, I don't know, maybe you can talk a little about that, maybe address that issue of how do you cope with trauma, because I'm sure everybody here has had some form of trauma. And then, of course, we'll take some questions and answers for Bill.
Well, one of the things that I kind of became in the course of following my spirit was an expert on trauma recovery. And I still speak on trauma recovery, if I can say it, fairly often. And I think that we've all had it. And I think Doug mentioned earlier that, you know, we've all experienced trauma in our life. And I found that this spirit that I met in that white light helped me tremendously to overcome that trauma and the emotional upheaval that I went through. And I had nightmares for 15 years after I came back from Vietnam, and I went through bouts of depression and the dissatisfaction with my life and struggled with those post-trauma issues. And I think that we all do that. I mean, it's not just unique to veterans. All of us have been traumatized at one time or another, and we all struggle. And it's important to know that the feelings that we have and the difficulties that we go through in recovering from that trauma are normal. In fact, what they call post-traumatic stress disorder, we used to call that's a normal response to an abnormal situation. Whenever you've gone through an abnormal situation, the normal response is to have post-traumatic stress and to have to go through a cycle of recovering from that. And I think that one of the biggest aspects of that is having the faith that you can recover. It's trusting in yourself. It doesn't matter how active or how big your spirit is. You know, even if it's just a teeny little glow inside of you, trust it. It will lead you out of that depth, out of that difficulty. It will take you to a better place. And you can learn how to cope with it. You'll never, ever forget what's happened to you throughout your life. But that doesn't mean it has to be all bad. I will never forget the trauma of war. I will never forget Vietnam. I will never forget the people whose lives that I took and the people whose lives that I saw lost in that war. Never. On either side. But I don't have to forget it. All I have to do is forgive myself and move on. It's not quite that simple, but it's doable. It's fixable. And we all have to live with the trauma of life. I mean, just, I don't care who you are. I mean, whatever you've done in this life, whether you've raised by great parents and had a wonderful career and, you know, are now retired and enjoying the good life, you know, or whether you've struggled every day of your life. We've all experienced bad times. We've all experienced traumatic events. We've all experienced hurt and pain. And that pain is survivable. Very, very survivable. And the quality of life can be very good. Sometimes you can do it on your own, and sometimes you need help. Sometimes it's just the help of friends and family. Sometimes you got to go get professional help. I saw a psychologist for several years, and in my own process of treating others, you know, I found my own treatment. In doing what I found was my purpose in life and what felt good, and being on that spiritual path, I found healing by doing what I felt was the thing that I was supposed to be doing on this earth. And it, I think if we all do that, if we follow that path, if we follow what we believe is our chosen path, that we can eventually recover. We can eventually let go of some of the pain and integrate that trauma into our life, make it a part of who we are. You don't forget it, but it becomes a part of your personality, becomes a part of who you are. It can actually make you a better person. You know, when you break an arm and the bone heals back and it's stronger at the place where it was broken. Well, mentally and emotionally, it's the same way. When we start to heal the broken parts, they become stronger. And we become a stronger person. And we can do many things that we never thought we could do. I never imagined 30 years ago, 35 years ago, that I could stand in front of a group and speak and speak coherently. it just wasn't, according to the doctors, it's not even possible. Even today, they say it's not possible. They look down my throat. Can't talk. You don't have vocal cords. It's not possible. Well, okay, it's not possible, but, you know, sometimes we do the impossible. Sometimes we press on. Sometimes we don't listen to those who say, you can't. And we understand in our heart what we can do. And that's where it comes from. It comes from in the heart, not in the head. And the heart drives us, and it keeps us going. I'm telling you, it's not easy, but it's doable. I live every day in pain, physical pain. It hurts. It hurts to stand here right now. It hurts to talk to you. Physically hurts. And tomorrow, when I get, after I've talked to you all night, or as long as you'll let me, I'm going to have to rest. I'm going to have to rest my voice. But, you know, that's okay. I'll rest it up a day, and then I'm heading down south, catch some sunshine down in Arizona, and a couple of baseball games. So that's my treat. And then I have to go talk again. But, it's, you do what you can, and you ignore what you can't. When I was working in the automotive industry, one of my jobs was to interview people that were coming in. I was interviewing all the new management people. And I was amazed at how many people would come in and tell me what they can't do. They go into a job interview and they tell you what they can't do. I didn't care what they can't do. I want to know what they can do. You know, what can you do for the company? What can you do to make things work? But only a handful actually told me what they could do. The rest told me what they can't do. And I think if we are focused on what we can't do when we're physically or mentally or emotionally disabled, we're defeated because all we can see is what we can't do. But if we look at what we can do, and that's what we pursue, and that's what we put our attention on, then that's what grows in our life. And then what we can't do becomes inconsequential. It doesn't matter. I'll never be an airline pilot. I'll never be a cop. I'll never be a corporate executive. Doesn't matter. That's not important. What's important is what I will be and what I will do. So focusing on our limitations takes us away from focusing on our purpose in life, which is what we can do. And when we start doing what we can do, we learn we can do much, much more. And we can take it to limits that people never even imagined possible. So I'm going to stop and answer questions if anybody has any questions. I think that gentleman had his hand up first. Basically, he was just a ball of light. Kind of a... he was not in a human form. I just recognized him. I don't know how I mean, it was his personality. It was uniquely him, and yet it didn't have his form. You know, I'd love to tell you that it was his nasty attitude, but I'm not sure that was it. But he was pretty nice to me then. But he just was. It was the essence of him. And I don't know. It's hard to describe. You know what? How you know? But those beings had, even though they looked all the same, they all looked like this ball of light. They had a uniqueness that was their own character. And so that was how I recognized them. Thank you very much. Thank you. There. Amazingly enough, yes. But not till many, many, many years later. I was having a new home built, and it wasn't ready. I had to move out of my other house, and the new house wasn't ready. And I had to live in a hotel for a while, like several months. And I was at this hotel, and I was reading the division newsletter that came out. I belonged to the American Health Division Veterans Association, which was the unit I served with in Vietnam. And there was a little ad at the bottom one page that said, "Do you know this man?" And his name was Tommy Heaton. Well, that was the man that died in my arms. So I called up that number. And it was a long-distance number, and I'm calling from a hotel telephone. And I think, it's going to cost me a fortune, but I got to call this guy. So I call him up, and he's back east somewhere. And he says, "Well, it really isn't me that's looking. It's a lady, young lady, and this guy was her father. She was looking for somebody that knew him in the Army." So he gave me her number, which was in Georgia. So I thought, okay, here we go. I got on the phone. I talked with her for an hour on a hotel telephone without a calling card or anything, billing it to my room. And we talked, and we had a wonderful talk. And I still have her address, and every once in a while I get a Christmas card from her. And we talked about her dad and, you know, what went on that day when he died. And she seemed to be quite relieved to hear from somebody. And amazingly enough, when I checked out of that hotel, phone bill never showed up on my bill. And it had to be a big one. And it never showed up. There was no phone bill whatsoever on my hotel bill. So it was amazing. That gives me shivers just thinking about it. Who else had a question? I think the bell in the back was first. Okay. Make them easy. I was just trying to be a soldier. I was just trying to fight back. I mean, you know, he was trying to kill me, and I just wanted to drive him away. Wanted to get him away from me, and whatever it took, basically. So,
have you ever heard of other soldiers having near-death experiences?
Actually, yeah, working for the VA, I've talked to quite a number that have had near-death experiences when they were wounded. And I think there's a couple of guys that have written books about their near-death experiences in the war. I've also talked to some Korean War vets and World War II vets who've also had near-death experiences when they were wounded. Actually, they did, yeah. The Army gave me actually quite a few medals. I was pleased. They gave me several Bronze Stars and Army commendations and a Purple Heart and a couple others to go along with it. So, yeah, they gave me some medals.
Yeah,
sure. When this guy joined my squad, he and I clashed right from the beginning. I mean, we didn't like each other. He wouldn't take orders from me. He was just a guy that I just didn't care much for, and he didn't care much for me. And we struggled the entire time to get along. But when I held him in my arms and he died, it was like instant brotherhood. There was a love that we shared for one another that was very unique, very uncommon. And to this day, I still feel that love for him and that caring for him, as I do for all people. And I learned from that experience to just forgive. And you know, not everybody's going to like you, and that's okay. And not everybody's going to be nice to you, and that's okay, too. It's not what other people do to you. It's what you do to other people. And it's how you treat people and how you care about people. And I try to live my life, you know, treating people as well as I can and you know, being satisfied with whatever I get from somebody else. And, you know, if they don't give me their best side, then maybe they're just having a bad day, and maybe they're just a miserable person. But that doesn't mean I have to be miserable back. So I try to be as pleasant as I can and as tolerant as I can of people who are struggling with life. And I learned that from Tommy because, you know, we just really did not get along well at all. And yet, at that moment of death, at that moment we were sharing the light, there was true brotherhood, there was true love, there was a true caring. And, you know, I would hope that that's the kind of thing that we could all share. You know, in all walks of life and with all people. And I firmly believe that there's a spiritual thread that runs throughout all people, all over the world. And I've traveled all over the country and in other parts of the world, and I've heard near-death experiences from all over the world, and they're saying the same thing. They're talking about the same spirit. They're talking about the same spiritual thread. And I think that it exists. It exists in all people, in all walks of life, all over the world. And, you know, it's, I don't go around hugging and kissing everybody I see, but I try to go around liking them, you know, at least try to find the best in them. Absolutely. It was the most wonderful experience of my life. Actually, you know, it's hard to say. You know, if you had to your life to live over again, if I had my life to live over again and I know what I know now, I don't know, maybe I would still do the same thing. I don't know. I don't regret what I did. I have no regrets whatsoever about it. It has made me a better person, even though it's made my life difficult, even though it's caused me a lot of pain. It has made me a better person, and it's made me appreciate life and the quality of life, and has allowed me to see beyond this life to the next. Maybe I would have, I don't know. You know, when I was a kid, when I was a young man, at 18, I was skeptical about everything. That's why I joined the Army and went to Vietnam. Because I didn't know what the heck we were doing there and why we were doing it. And the only way you're going to prove that it was of value was to go there and experience it for myself. That's, you know, because I just can't believe anything unless I experience it myself. So, you know, just to say would you do it differently, I don't know. It's, and maybe I would have had that near-death experience some other way had I not gone to war. I don't know. But my life happened exactly the way it happened. It's written in stone. I can't change one moment of it. So I'm not even going to worry about it. I'm not even going to worry about what happened. before. I'm only going to worry about what's happening right at this moment, because that's the only place I have any control. Right now, today, I don't know what tomorrow's going to bring, and I can't change what happened yesterday. I can't even change what I said 10 minutes ago. So, I could tell you something different, but it still doesn't change what I said. So, you know, that's a tough question to answer. Would you do it all over again? So, but I appreciate the question. The program was, as far as I know, there's quite a number of programs that work with people with severe mental illness and substance abuse. They call them dual disorder programs, or dual diagnosis, or they have a variety of different names for them. But what I did was I when I took the program over, I saw that the patients weren't doing well. What I saw was that they were bringing these patients into the hospital, treating them in a very structured environment, and then sending them out to a very unstructured environment. So I figured what has to happen in order for these people to go back out in the community and take the lessons that they're learning is to unstructure the program. So there I sat with all these crazy guys with no structure. We threw it all out the window. And if they all wanted to talk at the same time, I let them. And if they wanted to get up and walk around, I let them. And if they wanted to go smoke a cigarette, I let them. And if they wanted to go to the bathroom, I let them. And if they wanted to sleep, I let them. But I said to them, you're responsible for your behavior. That means if you get up and you go, as soon as you've done what you need to do, you come back. You're responsible. I'm not going to lock the door when it's time to start group therapy. I'm going to leave the door open. And it's your responsibility to come in on time and leave on time. If you need to go to the bathroom, then it's your responsibility to get up, go to the bathroom, come back. By throwing out all the structure and making them responsible, and making them responsible to talk in group, and them responsible for what was going on in their head, and making them responsible for taking their medication and doing the necessary things. And I would teach them what to do when they would tell me about, you know, the refrigerator's talking to me, what do I do? I would teach them alternatives, you know, how to check to find out if it's really talking to you, you know. And I would have them sometimes call my voicemail, listen to my voice and talk on my voicemail if they had to, you know, or call a friend. And we formed support groups, and I got them to go to movies and go out to dinner and go to baseball games and go bowling and, you know, do social things together. And essentially to live the kind of life that they really should be living, you know. I mean, just because they're crazy doesn't mean they're not allowed to be social and to have a life. And so I just helped them to do that in an unstructured way, a way that they could take with them that was more like the life they were living away from the hospital.